Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. Always wonderful to be with you on a Wednesday afternoon. So let's talk about some great ideas from the Torah readings we're going through. We're also going to look at some significant important milestones this week according to the Hebrew calendar. We'll end off with some ideas from this coming Torah reading, this coming week's parasha. So let's mention, I think, what is a very important, powerful idea with a great message for all generations. That we learned from last week's Torah reading. Last week's Torah reading was Parshas Toldos, and the Sedra began with the Pasuk, Ve'ele Toldos Yitzhak ben Avraham, Avraham Choyrid es Yitzhak. These are the generations of Yitzhak, the son of Avraham. And then the Pasuk continues, Avraham Choyrid et Yitzhak. Avraham was the father of Yitzhak. So the obvious question, which is asked by many of the Rishoni, many of the commentators, is why the redundancy, why the repetition in this pasuk? The Ibn Ezra says that that second part of the verse, Avraham Choyrid et Yitzchak, doesn't necessarily mean that Avraham's the father of Yitzchak, but it's telling us that Avraham raised Yitzchak. He was involved in his upbringing and had a great influence on his son's life. A second answer that Ibn Ezra brings is that Avraham was Yitzhak looked like his father. He resembled Abraham. And Rashi elaborates on this idea. And he says the Torah is telling us, the Torah is testifying to us that Yitzhak was the splitting image of his father of Abraham. And Rashi goes on to say, because that's coming to counter what Rashi calls, based on the Midrash, Leitzanei Hador, the scoffers, the mockers of the generation, would come up with the false liable that Yitzchak was not the son of Sarah, of Abraham, sorry, was the son of Sarah, not the son of Abraham, because Abraham and Sarah were married for many years and they didn't have any children. And then Sarah is abducted by Avimelech and suddenly she falls pregnant, she conceives. And so the scoffers of the generation will say that Abraham was not the father of Yitzchak, but rather Avimelech was the father of Yitzchak. And so in order to counter that claim, Hashem made it that Yitzchak looked exactly like his father. You know, sometimes you see a child who resembles the parents. So that's how Hashem set it up, that Yitzchak looked exactly like Avraham. And so there was just no doubt, there was no question. It was obvious and clear for all to see that this was Avraham's child. But Rav Pam, Rabbi Friend, quotes Rav Pam, who was the great Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas, who makes a wonderful observation. And he says that the Midrash says, Leitzanei Hador, the mockers, the scoffers of the generation. So those that are mockers and scoffers usually don't have so much credibility, and people don't believe them anyway. Why wouldn't they be believed? Because that's a very false claim, because Avraham already had a child. Avraham had Yishmael. Hagar was the mother of Yishmael, and Avraham was the father of Yishmael. So to come and say that Yitzhak's not the son of Abraham because he can't conceive, well, that's a false claim because he can conceive. He's got a son anyway. So Rav Pam says that in that generation itself, they wouldn't have taken that claim seriously. But he says in future generations, they perhaps would have taken them seriously because you always have the revisionist historians, those that come later. So at the time, when people are aware of the situation, the circumstances, the nuances, so they won't believe those false claims. But maybe in the future, those false claims will come up again and people won't have all the facts and all the background and the context, and they will believe the false claims in the future. The revisionist historians will deliberately perverse the truth and change the facts in order to suit their agenda. And so in order to counter the claim of future generations or the revisionist historians, So Hashem made sure that Yitzhak was the splitting image of Abraham, and therefore such a claim could never get off the ground in the first place, that in future generations they could come up with that claim. And it's a very powerful point that Rav Pam's pointing out over here from the Midrash, is that we always, in every generation, have these revisionist historians, these people that perverse the facts, that change the truth, that deliberately mislead others into falsities in order to push their own personal agenda. And of course, there are many examples in history, but there are two modern examples that I'll mention to you, that I'll share with you. The first one is the Holocaust. When the Allied forces, so the head of the Allied expeditionary forces in World War II was Dwight D. Eisenhower. He was the commander, the supreme commander of the D-Day invasion and of the Allied expeditionary forces in World War II. And he obviously was a very talented person, a superb general. For him to orchestrate the largest amphibious invasion in the history of warfare, there were 156,000 troops that landed on D-Day itself. There were 195,000 naval personnel that were involved in the invasion. There were 11,000 aircraft crew that were involved. So it makes 350,000 soldiers were directly involved in D-Day itself. There were 7,000 ships and landing craft involved in D-Day. There were 11,000 aircraft. So it's just a military operation of a phenomenal, mind-boggling scale. And he put it all together and dealt with all the difficult personalities of the generals and their allies and ensured that the D-Day invasions were a success, which were critical to the defeat of Germany and the success of the Allies in World War II. And as the Allies' forces pushed further and further into Germany, they began, to their shock and horror, to discover the death camps and the atrocities committed by the Nazis. And they immediately informed Eisenhower, and straight away he went to see for himself. And when he saw the unbelievable sights in front of his eyes, so he straight away said, the press needs to come and see this also and record this. And he called in the press, and they filmed and they photographed the death camps that had been liberated by the Allies. And Eisenhower said it was very important to do that because in the future, there will be people that will deny that this ever happened. And we need to gather evidence in order to counter those denials. And in fact, he even sent a message to George C. Marshall, who was the chief of staff of the United States Army, to recommend that a delegation from the government of the United States come and see for themselves. He sent a similar letter to Churchill. And so there were delegations that came from the United States government, from the British government, that actually had a look, that firsthand had a view of the death camps. Because Eisenhower knew that such false claims would arise with the revisionist historians. And unbelievably, we see today that there are people that deny the Holocaust, despite the overwhelming amount of facts and of evidence that we have to present that the Holocaust was true and real. There are many who push their own agenda to undermine Israel and undermine the Jewish people, that the Holocaust was just a fabrication of the Jews in order to garner sympathy from the world. So that's the first example of revisionist history that the Torah warns us about many thousands of years ago, and that we see is a reality of human life and the human condition that keeps on coming. We'll share one more when we come back after this break.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
So the second example of revisionist history, which we have to be aware of, alert of, be careful of, is of course the land of Israel. And I think that is the biggest scam, the biggest lie, the great libel of our times, is the claim that Israel is a colonialist state that Zionism is a colonialist enterprise and it stole the land from the indigenous people and it's not the land of the Jewish people. That is such a tremendous lie and such a falsehood and such a negation of history and of the truth. Because we know from the time the Jewish people entered into the land in 1300 before the Common Era under the leadership of Joshua, from that point up until today, which is more than 3,300 years, the Jewish people have always had a presence in the land of Israel. And in fact, the Jews were living as a nation for many, many centuries, for 1,900 years, even before Islam was ever invented. The Jews were living and thriving and inhabited the land of Israel. And even since the past those 1,900 years, we've had Jewish inhabitants and Jewish presence in the land throughout. Sometimes it was more, sometimes it was less, sometimes we were exiled, and there were less numbers of Jews in Israel, but sometimes there were more numbers of Jews in Israel, but there have always been Jews in Israel. And so to make the false claim that the Jewish people are usurping the indigenous Palestinians from their land, and it's their colonial aspiration that stole the land from the local people, is a complete open lie and libel against the Jewish people. It's always been our land. It's for more than 3,000 years. We were Jerusalem was the capital of Israel before London and New York and Paris even existed. And so to come with that false claim is just such a lie and something that all Jews should be aware of and we should counter and we should confidently proclaim the truth that Israel is our land and has always been our land and has always been the ancient homeland of the Jewish people. Okay, so let's discuss a few dates this week. So this past Shabbos was the second of the month of Kislev, according to the Jewish calendar. And the second of Kislev was the Yahrzeit of Rabbi Aaron Kotler. Rabbi Aaron Kotler passed away on the second of Kislev in the year 1962, which made it Rabbi Kotler's 63rd Yahrzeit. And Rav Kotler was the founder of the Beis Midrash Gavur in Lakewood, New Jersey. Rabbi Kotler was a student of the esteemed Slobodka Yeshiva. Before the war, he ran the Slutsk Yeshiva with his father-in-law, Rabbi Issa Zalman Maltzer. When World War II broke out, the yeshiva moved to Vilna in Lithuania, as most of the Lithuanian yeshivas did. For a time, they were safe over there because Vilna was an international city and hadn't yet been occupied by the Nazis or by the Russians. Ultimately, many perished at the hands of the Nazis after Operation Barbarossa in June 1941. So the Nazis invaded Russia and took over all these territories and murdered all the Jews. But many did escape successfully to Shanghai with the Mir Yeshiva. Rabbi Kotler himself was rescued by the Vahd Hatzolah in 1941, just before the Nazis invaders, which was the Vahd Hatzolah was active in trying to save Jews from Europe after World War II under the occupation of Soviet Russia. Rabbi Kotler first moved to the Upper West Side of Manhattan and then to Borough Park. In 1943, he founded the yeshiva in Lakewood with 15 students. By the time he passed away, 19 years later, in 1962, the yeshiva had grown to 250 students. Rabbi Kotler's funeral was one of the largest in Manhattan with 25,000 attendees. After the New York eulogies, his body was flown to Israel and he was met by another 30,000 mourners. Today, the Lakewood yeshiva has over 5,000 students and is the largest outside of Eretz Israel. The institution is still run by his grandchildren. His grandson, named after him, Rabbi Aaron Kotler, was here has had involvement in our community here also. But of course, we remember Rabbi Aaron Kotler as one of the great leaders of Klal Yisrael in the 20th century, and the seeds that he planted and the unbelievable fruits that have grown at Lakewood are a great source of inspiration for the Jewish world. And Lakewood is a massive center of religious Jewish life and of Torah learning, and all due to the incredible commitment and dedication of this great man, Rabbi Aaron Kotler. Okay, so let's now move on to today's day. Today is the 6th of Kislev, and today is an interesting anniversary. It's the anniversary of a resolution in the United Nations, which is exactly 50 years today, in 1975, the United Nations passed the resolution 3379 in the General Assembly by a vote of 72 in favor, 35 against, and 32 abstentions, that Zionism is racism. 50 years ago today. Unbelievable. This was the infamous Zionism is racism resolution. The votes in favor were mainly from the Soviet bloc and the Arab Muslim nations. That's important historically to have that in mind, because we see much of the anti-Semitism we face in the world today comes from similar sources, comes from those that support communism, those that are on the far left, that are Marxists, are communists, are socialists. So they turn out to be very anti-Israel, like the Soviet bloc was 50 years ago. And of course, the Arab Muslim nations that want to destroy Israel, they want to remove Jewish control of the land of Israel, that are waging a jihad against the land of Israel. So those two were allies back then, and that still is the case today that we see in the world, the far liberal left and the Arab Muslim nations. Then Israeli ambassador of the UN, Chaim Herzog, made an impassioned speech that ended with the words, "For us, the Jewish people, this resolution is based on hatred, falsehood, and arrogance, is devoid of any moral or legal value. For us, the Jewish people, this is no more than a piece of paper, and we shall treat it as such." The U.S. ambassador to the UN, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, delivered a speech against the resolution, including the famous line, "The United States does not acknowledge, it will not abide by, it will never acquiesce in this infamous act. A great evil has been loosened upon the world," he said. The position was revoked in 1991 with a UN General Assembly Resolution 4686. This was a prerequisite to the Madrid Peace Conference, insisted upon by Israel. U.S. President George H. Bush pushed through the revocation. So it was revoked in 1991. But it's interesting to note that the enemies of Israel continue to use the UN as a weapon to discredit, to undermine, to destroy Israel. And we shouldn't fall for it. We shouldn't think, oh, because the UN says something, that it's true and it's right. The UN has been overrun by the left and by the Arab Muslim countries, and they continue to use all the means to their disposal with many organizations around the world, like the ICJ and like the UN, in order to undermine, in order to discredit, in order to weaken Israel. So, for example, I'll give you one example of that. So the United Nations Human Rights Council, which was established in 2006, really was an attempt to destroy Israel, to undermine Israel, because since 2006, since its inception, the United Nations Human Rights Council has adopted 108 resolutions condemning Israel. So it's from 2006 to, in the 19 years it's been in existence, to 2025, there have been 108 resolutions condemning Israel, and there have only been 74 resolutions condemning all the other countries in the world combined. How's that? So Israel gets 108 condemnations, and the rest of the world combined only gets 74 condemnations. That's including the terrible atrocities happening all over the world, in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Somalia. None of those have had any resolutions against them. There have been some for Venezuela. There's been some for Iran. There's been some condemning Russia, some condemning Syria. But 108 verse 74 for Israel. So it shows the bias, the hypocrisy, and the attempt to use the UN as a tool to destroy Israel. And so we shouldn't be weakened. We shouldn't be deterred by such hypocrisy. And as Jews, we stand proud and we defend the land of Israel and we defend the people of Israel, And we know it is our ancient homeland, and we will fight and we will defend ourselves, and we will ensure that we continue to have a successful state of Israel that continues to thrive as the only Jewish state in the world. Okay, so let's move on. That's an interesting anniversary today, 50 years. So tomorrow, the 7th of Kislev, also what I find is a very interesting historical fact, is the anniversary of the Yotzat of King Herod. King Herod died on the 7th of Kislev in the year 4 before the Common Era. Because Herod was a wicked king, this day was observed as a holiday. Herod was the second son of Antipater, who was an advisor to the Hashmonaim king, Hyrcanus II. Antipater was an Idumean, which was a people that were forcibly converted to Judaism by King Alexander Yanai. Now, there was a big controversy whether the Idumeans were actually Jewish or not, whether it was a valid conversion or not. Most of the Chachamim of the time regarded it as an invalid conversion, as a false conversion, and that the Idumeans weren't really Jewish. And so they didn't see Herod as Jewish. Herod's first political role was as governor of the Galilee. He was eventually appointed by the Roman Senate as the king of Yehuda. The reason why I appointed Herod was because Herod was educated in Rome. His father sent him to Rome, and then all the Roman emperors and those that governed the Roman satellites around the world, they were friends of Herod. He was at school with them. And so they trusted him, and he then became a puppet for the Romans in the land of Israel. And therefore, obviously, the Jewish community, the Jewish inhabitants in the land, did not trust him at all. He then proceeded to kill any threat to his rule, including the remnants of the Hashmonaim, who were the family that led the rebellion against the Greeks a few centuries before. And he even killed, Herod was so paranoid and so brutal, he even killed members of his own family. He even killed his sons in order to prop up his rule. Besides being a bloody murderer, Herod was a great builder. He rebuilt the second Beis HaMikdash, and the grand scale of Beis Shin, the second Beis HaMikdash, was under the directive and the orchestration of Herod. He built the mountain retreat of Masada, so the ruins of Masada were all built by Herod. He built the port of Caesarea, of Caesarea, and the building of Maras Machpelah. So I'm sure many of our listeners have been to Hebron and Maras Machpelah, and we know there's a very big building over there. That was also built by Herod. Knowing that he was not a beloved ruler in his kingdom, he left in his will, on the day that he died, 300 of the leading rabbonim, of the sages, of the chachamim, should be crucified on the day that he died. That was his instruction. That way, his death would be a day of mourning for the Jewish people, and they would mourn him as well. The order, Baruch Hashem, was not carried out, and the day of his passing, therefore, instead became a holiday. So tonight and tomorrow, 7th of Kislev, is the anniversary of the death of Herod. Exactly 2,029 years ago. And it is a day of celebration because Herod was a very evil individual. Okay, so let's move on now. And let's discuss on Thursday, that is the 8th of Kislev. The 8th of Kislev is actually the anniversary of the death, the Yahrzeit of Golda Meir. Golda Meir died in the year 1978. And she was the former prime minister of Israel. She was born in Kiev, Russia, which was subjected to brutal pogroms, and moved with her family to Milwaukee in the United States at the age of 8. 10 years later, while organizing an American protest march against the continued Russian pogroms, she decided to make Aliyah. Golda Meir became involved in politics at age 24, and it was one among the signers of Israel's declaration of independence. She became Israel's first ambassador to the Soviet Union and served as prime minister during the tense time of the 1973 Yom Kippur War. She was severely criticized for the Yom Kippur War because there was a lot of intel coming in saying that our enemies were amassing troops on our borders, and she chose to ignore the intel and she followed the instructions of the United States that Israel should not do anything unless it's attacked. And that was a very bad mistake because Israel was almost overrun in 1973. And the Yom Kippur War was caught by surprise, a little bit like October 7th. And she was held to account as a result. Although she was a very great woman and did very many wonderful things for the Jewish people, but that was a dark part of her political career. She once said, "Peace will come when the Arabs love their children more than they hate us. That's when we'll find peace in the Middle East." A very wise words. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that all the way till our time, but please God, Be'ezras Hashem, we will see peace in the Middle East, and Golda Meir's wish will come true that the Arabs will love their children more than they hate us. Okay, so this coming Friday, the 9th of Kislev, is the anniversary of, in 1940, a boatload of 1,600 Jewish immigrants fleeing Hitler's ovens was denied entry into the port of Haifa. So on the 9th of Kislev, 1940, there were 1,600 Jews that were on a boat, and they weren't allowed to enter into Haifa. The British deported them to the island of Mauritius. At the time, the British had acceded to Arab demands and restricted Jewish immigration into Palestine. The urgent plight of European Jewry generated an illegal immigration movement, but the British were vigilant in denying entry. Some ships, such as the Struma, sunk, and hundreds of passengers were killed, and Eretz Yisrael became locked and closed to the Jewish people, and the Jews of Europe had nowhere to go, and they unfortunately faced the terrible fate of being murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. Certainly the British were accomplices because they didn't allow Jews into the land of Israel. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
Let's end off with two fascinating ideas we see in this week's Torah reading. So V'yetze Yaakov, this week's Parsha's V'yetze. Yaakov has to leave the home of his parents because he knows that Esav is after him. His mother has warned him that Esav now wants to kill him. Since Yaakov has bought the Bechorah, the right of the firstborn, which is very significant, and also received the blessings from their father Yitzchak. And Yaakov also needs to find a wife. And so he is instructed by his parents to go to Haran, to go to the place of his mother's birth, and to find a wife over there. And so he travels to Haran, and the Torah tells us he lays down to rest, and he has a dream. He has an incredible dream where God speaks to him in the dream. It hasn't happened to me for a few nights. God spoke to me in my dreams. Don't know about you, but it happened to Yaakov because, of course, he was a spiritual giant and he was a very, very great soul. And God clearly communicates to him the famous dream about the ladder, Sulam Mutzav Arts of Rosh Magia Shemaima, that the ladder reached the ground and the head of the ladder was at the top. Malachi Hashem Olim V'Yordim Bo, the angels were going up and down the ladder. And so at the end of the dream where God promises Jacob that he will look after him, that he will protect him, that despite the dangers that he will face in the home of Lavan, Hashem, God, will ensure that Jacob is successful and achieves his goals. And the Torah then tells us in Perek Chavches, Pasuk Tes Zayin, it says, V'yikatz Yaakov Mishnasoi. And Jacob wakes up from his slumber, V'yoymer, Achen Yesh Hashem B'makom Hazeh. And because of that dream, he realizes that God is in this place. V'anoichi lo yadati. And he says, and I didn't know. So Rashi says, V'anoichi lo yadati. He's telling us, quoting the Midrash, that Jacob says, if I would have known, I would never have gone to sleep. If I knew this was such a holy place, and we know that this place was the Makom HaMikdash, was the place where the Beis HaMikdash was the place where Abraham took Isaac for the Akedah, was that place what we call the interface between physical and spiritual, the place where all bracha and blessing from the higher worlds emanates into this world. That's the place, the Makom HaMikdash. So he didn't sense it before, but now you realize it was a holy place. And he said, well, if I would have known, I wouldn't have gone to sleep. That's the basic understanding of the Pasuk. But the holy Baal Shem Tov teaches us a beautiful interpretation of this Pasuk, which is so powerful and so relevant to this day. I heard this from Rabbi Shmuel Silber. And the Baal Shem Tov says, V'yikatz Yaakov Mishnaso, and Jacob awakens from his slumber. That's a message for all of us, for every Jew at all times, is sometimes we live life in a way that we are sleepwalking. We fall asleep at the wheel, and then we are awoken. Something happens in which we snap out of our slumber and we realize, wow, where am I? What have I been doing with my life? Why have I made these choices? How come my relationships look as they do? And we wake up and we realize that this is not where we want to be. And we need to ensure that we move away from this place and we implement changes in our life that will take us to a better place. And so when that happens, V'yikas Yaakov Mishnaso, when a Jew awakens from our sleep, V'yomer Achen Yesh Hashem B'makom Hazeh, so he will say, I know that Hashem is in this place. Even though I've strayed, even though I've wandered away from the correct path, even though I find myself in this dark place as a result of my bad choices, in whatever it is in our lives, wherever we may be, whatever we may have done, when we have that awakening, so we must always realize, Hashem b'makom hazeh, Hashem is here, Hashem is with me, Hashem is b'makom hazeh, in this place. And even though it's a dark place, and even though it's a place that has I've strayed and wandered from the right path, Hashem is here with me. And so says the Baal Shem Tov, there's always a way back. There's always a solution to the problems. And we have the ability, with the help of Hashem, when we realize Hashem is with me, even in the darkest place, even a place where we find ourselves in severe darkness, Hashem is there. And that means I have the capacity to change and to shift and to improve. And v'anoichi lo yadati, the pasuk ends, and I didn't know. Anoichi, so the Baal Shem Tov's v'anoichi means the anoichi, the essence of who I am, the holy neshama that is within me. Lo yadati, I didn't know myself in this place, in this dark place, because my neshama has been negated. The anoichi that I find myself in right now, lo yadati, is foreign and is strange and is not true to my essence and to who I am. So how do I get away from this? How do I change this? How do I go beyond this? It's a very difficult thing. So the Baal Shem Tov says, because we have to know that Hashem is with us. We have to know that Hashem is always with us, no matter where we are. And so what a beautiful interpretation. So when we wake up from our slumber, Hashem is here with me, even though I'm in a dark place, and I don't recognize myself. Hashem is the way out. Hashem is the ticket to improvement and to shifting and to getting to the place that we have the potential to be, the great holy beings that is a part of every one of us. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
Jewish Women's Benevolent Society is hosting their final book sale of 2025 this Sunday, the 30th of November, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Come browse an incredible range of books at great prices. For more information, call 011-485-5232 or email office at jwbs.co.za. Don't miss the last book sale of the year. So let's end off with one final idea, a very beautiful and powerful idea. That is, we know that Yaakov goes to the house of Laban, and Yaakov was a shepherd. He meets Rachel at the well, which was the common meeting place because everybody needs to get water. And she introduces him to her father, and he requests of her father that he should be able to marry Rachel. Instantly, they knew they were soulmates and had this very deep and powerful spiritual connection. And his father said, yes, but you have to work for me for 7 years in order to be able to marry her. And Yaakov agrees, and he does so. The Torah says that they passed like Yamim Machadim very quickly because of his great love for Rachel. And on the wedding night, so both Yaakov and Rachel were suspicious of Lavan, because Lavan was a gangster, he was a swindler, he was a very dishonest person. And they knew that he would try and deceive them, and he would try and replace Rachel with her older sister Leah. And so they came up with a very ingenious scheme that they will have simanim, signs, to indicate that it's the right person, because in those days they had no electricity. And so at night, on the first night, it would be difficult to tell who it was. It was pitch black. And so they came up with these codes. Some say the code was Chala, Neiros, Nida. So anyway, this code comes up. And Rachel, at the last minute, has cold feet. And she realizes that it's a good chance her father will try to deceive them. But if Yaakov discovers that is Leah, not Rachel, on the first night, so Leah would be terribly humiliated. It would be a very, very painful and embarrassing moment for her, and everybody would find out. And it really would be the event that would cause great distress and trauma to her sister. And so she puts aside her own desires and her own deep, deep wish to marry Yaakov, and she gives the simanim over to Leah. What an incredible act of selflessness in order to save her sister from humiliation. And there's an amazing, amazing midrash that says that when the Jewish people were exiled to Babel after the destruction of Bais Rishon, the first Beis HaMikdash, so in Shemaim, in the heavens, the midrash in Eicha tells us, in the Hakdamah to Eicha, and in the Psicha, and it's Perek Chaf Dalet, if you want to look it up, it's really worthwhile. So it says that Avraham Avinu goes to Hashem and says that I was prepared to sacrifice my son. And Yitzchak goes and says, I went onto the Akedah. And Yaakov says that I dedicated my life to you, Hashem, with my family. And Moshe says, I was the great shepherd of the Jewish people. All of them begged Hashem that in the merit of their lives, Hashem should save the Jewish people from the exile. And Hashem doesn't respond to them. And Rachel goes to Hashem and said, I gave my sister the simanim in order that I wouldn't embarrass and humiliate her. And so Hashem, please have, I had compassion on my sister, so please have compassion on the Jewish people. And Hashem, the only one Hashem answered was Rachel. And Hashem says, quoting the pasuk in Yirmiyah, the pasuk says, Koma Hashem, kol barama nishma, a great voice is heard in Shemayim. Rachel mevaka al baneh, Rachel cries for her children. Koma Hashem, stop, you don't have to cry anymore. And your eyes don't have to pour tears. Because there is reward for your actions, Rachel. And finally, the pasuk says, the children will return to their borders. In the merit of Rachel, they'll return. So the great Rav Yaakov Weinberg says, why? Why is the only great spiritual power that's answered is Rachel and not any of the Avos or Moshe Rabbeinu? And he says, because when we are asking Hashem for compassion, we have to live with compassion. If we bring compassion to this world, so Hashem responds with compassion. And so all of us, it's such a great idea. All of us need compassion in our lives, in our personal lives. We need Hashem's compassion. We need help with our health. We need help with our relationships. We need help with our parnosa. We need help with our spiritual growth and defeating the Eitz Hara. So we have to behave and treat others with compassion, and Hashem will treat us with compassion. And likewise, on a national level, Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, we need divine compassion. We see the whole world is against us. They all want to destroy us. They spread such lies about us and such libel. And we need Hashem's compassion in the safety and success of the Jewish people. And so, therefore, we should all live lives of compassion. Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.